There we go. Aha, thank you. Recording in progress. So, okay. So, just in response to Adam, I mean, normally most observant Orthodox Christians, I'm going to turn this email off so it doesn't keep popping up on me. There you go. We'll have an icon corner in their house. We don't really put up icons for decoration, although oftentimes, depending on the household or the family, there may be an icon in every room, but many times it's just up in one corner, usually in the east corner. We do everything east. Christ rises, the sun rises in the east, Christ rises in the east. You see, the altar, all altars are in the east end of a church, at least ideally, unless some building was reconfigured to be a church at some point, and there wasn't any way to do it in the east. But generally, altars are in the east, so icon corners are generally in the in as much of an eastern corner as you can do, oftentimes there'll be, a Christ and the Theotokos, and sometimes a family icon or a particular saint that the family venerates, or maybe icons of different people of the saints of the different members of the family. So it can vary somewhat, but we say our prayers in our I say my prayers in my icon corner when I don't just do anything willy-nilly like that. And if you're any kind of a student of like human nature, praying in the same place is similar to studying in the same place. Many people when they're learning how to study, learning how to go to school, they'll say, find a spot where this is where you do your work. This is where you do your study. And you kind of develop a relationship, you develop a space, you develop a kind of an atmosphere in that place, and then you enter into it and you get right to work. You don't have to rearrange everything all the time or, try to fix things. No, it's there for you. It's waiting for you. And that actually kind of segues a little bit into what I want to talk about with saints. I want to talk about particularly the saints of North America, or what are considered the saints of North America. I mean, we're relatively, in comparison to the rest of the known world, we're a relatively new continent, newly inhabited continent. We're looking at, 400 plus years or 500 years or something. It's not we're not we don't go back 1,000 years. We don't go back 2,000 years in terms of the normal inhabitants of America. I mean, I suppose there were indigenous, supposedly there were indigenous people here for times before that. But when it comes to Christianity or the migration of Europeans, et cetera, we're a lot newer than that. So when we think of saints, then, I mean, growing up, when I would think of saints, I would think of people that were around a long time ago. Long ago, there were saints, and now there's just people, And on the other hand, you do have somewhat in the in certain of the Protestant churches, they'll think everyone is a saint. Well, everybody who accepts Christ is a saint, and I mean that's there's some bit of truth to that. They certainly everyone who accepts Christ into their life has the potential of being a saint. But when we talk about saints, we're speaking of very particular people. One of the great saints of our church, that is, when I say our church, our local church, the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, our particular jurisdiction of the Orthodox Church, one of our most revered saints, especially in North America, particularly, is Saint John of Shanghai in San Francisco. And we'll talk about him a little bit more as we go along. But he said this about saints. He said, sanctity is not just a virtue. It's an attainment of such spiritual height that the abundance of God's grace, which fills the saint, overflows on all who associate with him. Great is the saint's state of bliss in which they dwell, contemplating the glory of God. Being filled with the love for God and man, they are responsive to man's needs, interceding before God and helping those who turn to them. So this is true in life as they walk in our midst and in our understanding in the life which is to come. And so when we talk about praying, when people, you know, reference praying to saints, we're really asking a saint who we maybe have revered right along, or maybe have developed a spiritual relationship with, to help us bring our prayer before God. God is the one that answers prayers. Saints don't answer prayers, so to speak. They intercede for us before God. They bring our prayers before God. Why? Because oftentimes we're weak. So of course in the relatively new Orthodox presence that we have in North America, we have a list of saints that are associated with North America. Some people get very ambitious about this in a certain way. They're very enthusiastic. They want to say, the first saint who stepped foot in North America, they'll reference Saint Brendan the Navigator. Who was Saint Brendan the Navigator? He was a Celtic saint, but in the fifth century, he was the sixth century Celtic saint. Supposedly, he had voyages to Wales and to England and points west of Ireland. So coming towards, you know, Iceland, Greenland, Newfoundland and Canada, you know. And so there is some legend about that. There's a certain amount of legend about that. There were certain people who were naysayers and said, well, you know, the little boats that they floated around in, that it could possibly have made the voyage. And yet, in, I forget it was, let me look at this over here, see what year it was. It was in 1976, an Irish explorer, Tim Severin, built an ox leather curragh, that's the kind of boat, a replica of the sort Brendan would have used, and over two summers sailed from Ireland via the Hebrides, Faroe Islands, and Iceland to Newfoundland to demonstrate that the saint's purported voyage was feasible. So even without miraculously being allowed to make it to the new world, as we call it, it was indeed possible for him to sail here. And so it's not wrong saying that Saint Brendan the Navigator has some relationship with North America, with the North American continent, and yet he's probably not one of the most the one who stands out the most. But if we think back on that statement by Archbishop John, by Saint John Maximovich, the abundance of God's grace which fills the saint overflows on all who associate with him. And it overflows on all places that he goes, all places that he goes. So if you have a person who is sanctified, as the case may be, where he walks is blessed. What he touches is blessed. Where he dwells or has dwelt is blessed. There's an overflow of this grace, and grace is eternal. It doesn't just go away. And so, you know, it's a very nice thought that Saint Brendan the Navigator brought this grace of early Christianity, because it was really talking about the sixth century, and Celtic Christianity, which was very very protected from a lot of the ups and downs of things in Western Europe. Even over that time, he brought a very, very pure and bright manifestation of Christianity to our shores. And he didn't end up staying here. He ended up going back. It was supposedly, there's some legend that he set up a monastery for a short time, and then they went back. They went back to Ireland. So it's kind of very interesting. When we speak about saints of North America, though, more often we start looking towards the saints, the Russian missionaries who came to Alaska. Alaska, as you know, was part of Russia, was owned by Russia up until after the Civil War, after the 1860s, I think. It was sold for like $7.5 million to the United States. there were fur trappers and fishermen and various kinds of mercenary people who were in Alaska making money, making a living. And they were kind of a wild and rambunctious bunch. And so the head of the Russia America Company asked for missionaries to be sent to sort of like get them a little bit more centered, you know, in what they were doing. They were being very evil to the indigenous people. They were doing, you know, they were just you know, wild and crazy bunch. So they petitioned it was St. Petersburg at the time, I think, was the seat of the Patriarchate, and or the Metropolitanate. I don't, this was after Peter, I think. So there wasn't a patriarch, but they petitioned, and they went to Valam Monastery. Valam Monastery is in Lake Ladoga. It's north of St. Petersburg, north and sort of like north and west a little bit of St. Petersburg. It's a great big lake. There's a monastery in the middle of it called Valam. And they asked for volunteers. And they got a group of volunteer monks who said that they would go to Alaska. Among them were Saint Herman, who became Herman of Alaska, and also Saint Juvenali was another of the monks that went there. They initially went there and they tried to get themselves going as missionaries, and you know, dealing with both the Russian America Company, but also with the native peoples. At one point, many of them took a trip back to Russia for some reason, and then on the return to Alaska, they're shipwrecked and they all dropped. So there was a bunch of them that the initial missionaries that drowned and never had a chance to do much. Juvenali stayed in Alaska, and he ended up being martyred while he was preaching the gospel to native peoples. He crossed somebody's path the wrong way, and he was martyred. So he was one of the early, probably the one of the early, certainly the first hierom martyr in the New World, the Orthodox hierom martyr. Saint Herman, on the other hand, was not a priest monk. He was a regular, just a simple monk, but he was a deep ascetic. He had been an ascetic at Valam, and he continued his asceticism. He helped out the Russia America Company. He preached to them. He encouraged them to be true Christians, but he also took care of native people. And he ended up going to a little island called Spruce Island, which is off of Kodiak Island, and was virtually the only inhabitant there for a while. But gradually he took orphans to that he would take care of. And he lived out his life there for many years until he finally reposed in the Lord. And when he reposed, some of the native children saw this beam of light flash up into the sky, as if he was, you know, flying up into heaven. So Saint Herman is seen as one of the first real substantial saints of North America. And as I said, they were establishing the first mission there. There was also a young man, Peter the Aleut, who was an indigenous person, an Aleut Alaskan, and he was captured by some Spaniard sailors and brought down to California to one of the missions in California, where he was they decided they wanted to turn him into a Roman Catholic, and they tortured him. They tortured him and tortured him, and he wouldn't give over. And finally, he was martyred. They started cutting off his fingers, his toes, and then his hands, his feet. They just and just disemboweled him. I mean, it was really quite, I don't know, it's not exactly a great way to make a convert, in my opinion, but he ended up being a martyr and finding his way to heaven. So he's considered almost the proto-martyr of America, the proto-martyr, the first martyr in America. Again, Orthodox. I think what's interesting is the whole reason that these that missionary work went on from Russia, and that, other than taking care of their people who were in various places, but and that missionary work in any sort of Christian context really comes from Matthew 24:14, and Matthew 24:14 says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." And so there was a mandate to preach the gospel in the whole world. Saint John Maximovich would say that gospel has to be preached in an Orthodox context. In other words, it has to be rightly preached. Rightly preached, not just to preached healing any way we want to, not preached in a way that we are given our ideas, but given the idea that's passed down from the holy apostles through the ages. This gospel has to be preached in every place, and then the end shall come. Well, do we want the end to come? I mean, do missionaries really want the end to come? I mean, as Christians, we're sort of like a little ambivalent about this. On the one hand, of course, we want the end to come. We want Christ to come again. We want Christ to come and to gather up his own and bring us into eternal bliss, eternal joy in the heavenly kingdom, don't we? I think that we do. This is the whole idea of Christianity, is to be gathered up by Christ and brought to eternal joy. On the other hand, those of us who are sinners and who don't want the end to come too quickly, because we want to be on the right hand and not on the left hand. We want to be those who are gathered up and not among those who are thrown down. So, and on the one hand, we do hope for and anticipate the end coming, the end of time, the end of mortality, the end of materiality, and the coming of eternity and eternal joy and eternal bliss. We have, most of us, myself at least, I can speak for myself, I have a lot to do to be ready for that end to come, even for my end to come, let alone the end. So, but this is the kind of the impetus for preaching the gospel in all places. So Saint John, he I mean excuse me, Saint Herman of Alaska, he said when he was met with these fur traders, and they were being, they were, being wild and crazy and mistreating the Indians. He told them, he went to them, and he said that we had to love God, and that we had to love him. We had to pledge our love to God right from this moment on, from this moment on. And he really inspired them to live differently, and inspired all of these indigenous people, so especially the orphans. Herman of Alaska, and then Juvenali, proto-martyr. Peter the Aleut is another proto-martyr. After One of the principal people who came after Saint Herman. Saint Herman died 1837, and Saint John Veniaminoff, who became eventually Bishop Innocent of Alaska, was born in 1797, died in 1879. I believe it was in the mid 1800s. Well, it was early in the 1800s that he came to, he again volunteered to be a missionary to Alaska. So he took his wife and his mother and his whatever children, one, I think they had one child at the time, and left from Irkutsk, which was in Siberia. And it took him a year, took him a full year to get to Alaska. So they finally got to Alaska. He got there and you know, there were some Russians there. There were some people who had even been converted to Orthodoxy, some indigenous people. But he knew that he had a lot of work to do. So he was, St. Innocent is, or John Veniaminoff, St. Innocent is one of my absolute heroes. He went to Alaska and he looked around. He said, ah, well, the first thing I have to do is teach them how to make warmer homes. So he taught them. He was a very skilled builder could work with his hands. So he taught them how to make warmer homes. And then he said, well, if we're going to establish Orthodoxy here, we need to translate the scriptures into their language. Well, they didn't even really have a written language. So he went about creating a written language for the indigenous people and, you know, taking their language and finding a way to express it in writing, and then translated the Orthodox services and the scriptures so that they could understand them. And then he was willing to begin reaching out to them, preaching to them, and kind of encouraging them to be Orthodox Christians. He didn't feel he was really worthy to approach them until he could do it intelligently, and that he was there really to help them. He at one point he was called back to Russia to meet with the head of the Russian Church. While he was there, he got news that his Matushka, his wife, had passed away. And so while he was in Russia, they made him, now that he was not married anymore, his wife was passed away, they consecrated him a bishop and sent him back there as a bishop. So he became Bishop Innocent of Alaska. He was named after, because he had come from Irkutsk. There was a Innocent of Irkutsk. He was named for Innocent of Irkutsk, the saint who had preceded him by some generations. And he went back to Alaska and he labored among the people. He labored. There are wonderful stories about him. I encourage you to read about his life and his works. Again, he constantly was involved with helping the people. And he had an indigenous man who was a convert who traveled with him. They would get in a kayak and go and kayak all from the mainland in Alaska, all down through the Aleutian chain of islands. So hundreds and hundreds of miles they would kayak, and they would stop at islands and preach the gospel to whatever indigenous people were there. There's a wonderful story about getting to one particular island. On this island there was a native Alaskan elder, He was an elder of the people, and he told his people. He said, there's somebody very special coming. So he told them all to dress up in their finest dress and to meet him at the shore. So Bishop Innocent and his fellow traveler pull up on the shore. And here's all these people there greeting him. And he said, what? How did you know? How did you know to greet me? Oh, the elder told us to come down and greet you. So he said, well, bring me. to him, and he went and he talked to this elder, and the elder told him that an angel had appeared to him and told him that that Bishop John was coming, and that they should, you know, they should go and they should listen to him, and they should, you know, of course, John Bishop Innocent thought that his initial thought was a demon, must be a demon, and so he didn't want to give any credence to it until he finally got in touch with Russia, and he kind of went back and forth about this, and they told him, well, go ahead and go and talk to him again. They went to talk to him, and he had passed away. This elder had passed away, but he went ahead and he evangelized the people, and they became the village became Orthodox Christian. So Innocent of Alaska, later on in the mid around the 1860s, I think, or late 1860s, he was once again called back to Russia. He went there and he became Metropolitan of Moscow. So he became virtually the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, because the Metropolitan of Moscow was the head of the Orthodox Church. There was no Patriarchate after Peter the Not So Great abolished the Patriarchate. So until once again Tikhon came back, we'll get to him in a little bit. So those are some of the earliest saints of North America, and then. But Orthodoxy was getting established there. There was a growing diocese in Alaska, and it stretched all the way down into California. They eventually moved the center of the diocese down to San Francisco, and so the ruling bishop of the Russian Church would reside in San Francisco, and he would kind of work out of there. And I think the bishop at that time was after that was a Bishop Nicholas, and then eventually in 1898, Bishop Tikhon came from Russia and became the bishop of the Aleutians and Alaska. He eventually changed the name of the diocese to the Aleutians and North America, and then he moved the seat of the diocese to New York City, because it was, you know, there was Orthodoxy for, you know, already 100 years on the West in Alaska and in the West Coast, but it was just beginning to happen across America, especially with all the immigrants coming in through places like New York. So he moved the diocese, the seat of the diocese, to New York City, but he would still take missionary journeys all over the place. There are wonderful stories about Tikhon. This bishop, then Archbishop Tikhon, eventually became Patriarch Tikhon, who was the restoration of the Patriarchate in Moscow after the Russian Revolution, and then was eventually martyred by the Bolsheviks. But while he was in America, he was also a great missionary, and would take, there are stories of him traveling on dog sleds, and, you know, up through the Midwest, up and through the snow, up into Minnesota, up into Minneapolis, because there were Orthodox Christians up there, and to various places. He's the one who really established St. Tikhon's monastery in Pennsylvania, which is, it was named for St. Tikhon of Zadonsk, which is who he was named for, actually. When he was made a bishop, he was made named Tikhon, but he named the monastery in Pennsylvania for, and it's a seminary of St. Tikhon of Zadonsk. So eventually he, as I said, he was called back to Russia. He served there in a couple of different dioceses for maybe 10 or more years, and then he was called into Moscow, and they had the Sobor after the revolution. They had an all Russia Sobor, and he was elected patriarch. They decided to reestablish the patriarchate. All of the rules that Peter had set down, Peter the Great had set down, were abolished by the Bolsheviks anyway. So they reestablished the patriarchate. He was among three candidates. One of the other candidates was actually Metropolitan Anthony Krapovitsky, who became eventually the first hierarch of the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. He was the first hierarch of the church outside of Russia after the revolution. Shortly after, even before Tikhon was martyred, some of the bishops of Metropolitan Anthony, he was from Kiev actually originally, but he had then they ended up in Belgrade in Yugoslavia, and then I think he passed away while they were in Belgrade and was succeeded by Metropolitan Anastasi, who eventually came to America as well. So, but Tikhon was a great missionary. He was a great bishop, archbishop, and he was a man of great prayer and great sanctity, as well as a holy martyr. He established and blessed the cornerstone of the St. Nicholas Cathedral in New York City. It's on, we're on 93, it's on 97th Street, I believe, 97th off of Park Avenue. It's still there. He was involved in establishing that. They had a smaller church, and then they built this big cathedral. That was the seat of the archdiocese for the Russian church in America. He was aided in that a lot by another very interesting Russian who became a new martyr. His name is Alexander Hotovitsky. Alexander Hotovitsky was also, he had also come over from Russia. Let me see when he came over. I think he was, he was probably 1907 or so. He came and he served with Bishop Tikhon until 1907 when Tikhon went back to Russia. But he stayed and he helped establish that cathedral in New York City. He also went around to some of the UNIAT parishes that had come from Cilicia and the Carpatho Russians. Some of them were UNIATs. That means they were like Eastern Rite Catholics. Eastern Rite Catholics. There was a church actually in Passaic, New Jersey. There's a large Peter and Paul Cathedral in Passaic, New Jersey, that he was instrumental in bringing them from Uniatism back into the fullness of the Orthodox Church. So Alexander Hotovitsky, another interesting thing about Alexander Hotovitsky that kind of ties him to us is that he was in 1914, when Russia signed a peace treaty with Japan, that was the Russo-Japanese War before that. They signed a peace treaty. They signed that peace treaty in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And Alexander Hotovitsky came up with from New York City to sing a Moyeben before the signing of this peace treaty. It's very interesting because in 2014, 100 years after 100 years, they had like a gathering in Portsmouth, a reenactment, so to speak, of this signing of this historic treaty. And our Father Constantine was asked to come and stand in the place of Alexander Hotovitsky. You know, so they wanted to kind of have a recreation kind of picture, a recreation kind of gathering. And they asked him to stand in the place of Alexander Hotovitsky. So Father Constantine's always been a big fan of Alexander Hotovitsky. Alexander went back to Russia and he ended up, I don't know, very early on also was martyred in Russia. So even though he was a very holy man and very, very accomplished in church matters, he's really venerated as a saint because of his martyrdom. There was another martyr from the same time period, John Kucherov, who was a very missionary-minded priest in the Chicago area. He also went back to Russia and was one of the first martyrs of the after the revolution, one of the first clergy hieromartyrs in Russia. So that gets us up. And then after, I think it was, well, let's see, John Kucherov, then Okhovetsky, back over here. Let me see if I missed anybody. During the Second World War, there was another famous cleric, Bishop Nikolai Velimirovic, who was a Serb, who came to the United States and taught in St. Tikhon's. He taught at St. Vladimir's. He taught at the Serbian seminary up in Libertyville, Illinois. He was considered the new Chrysostom, the new Chrysostom. He was the golden mouth of the Serbian Church. A wonderful saint, wonderful writings, wonderful things that he did. There was another Serbian saint also in California, who was around the same time as Saint Tikhon. When Saint Tikhon came to take over the Russian diocese in San Francisco, in right after the turn of the century, was 1907 or whatever it was, right around there. This Sebastian Dobovich, Archimandrite Sebastian Dobovich, met him at the train station, and helped him find his way around San Francisco. Got to know him, and Sebastian Dobovich also became a great. He was ordained and by the Russians. He was the first American-born person who was ordained a priest in the Orthodox Church. Sebastian Dobovich from California. He also was a great missionary. He was constantly, this was after, especially after the Russian Revolution, he was worked very even before, actually, from 1905 on, he worked very hard to organize the Serbians emigrating to the US. And he worked very hard to organize their communities, make sure they had churches, make sure they had clergy. He worked very closely with the Russian church, to the degree that they were going to have him set up a whole Serbian sort of exarchate, so to speak, to deal with the Serbs. And then the revolution came, and it all that kind of thing fell apart. And so they set up their own, they sent their own bishop to take over, to deal with the Serbs in America. But he was a very very much considered the Serbian apostle to America, Sebastian Dobovich, and like I said, the first American-born man who was ordained a Orthodox priest. Seems strange. I mean, when you think of the eons, the centuries that came before over in Europe and in the Middle East of people being ordained and where they came from, this was, already it was 1892 that he was ordained a priest by the Russian bishop, Bishop Nicholas, in San Francisco. But he was the first American born. Let's see. And then probably the next, well, there are a number of people who are mentioned. I think, say, the Antiochian Church glorified a bishop, Raphael Hawaini. Raphael Hawaini was a originally he came from obviously from Syria, from the Middle East. But when he came to minister to Syrian immigrants in the New York area, he was made a bishop, a vicar bishop by Saint Tikhon. So he was a he because the Russian Church was the first established the first diocese in North America, then all other churches really were under the Russian Church. We're under the auspices of the Russian Church. So the Serbs operated under the Russian Church, under the Amaphore, the Russian Church. So did the and so did the Syrians, the Antiochians. And so Raphael Houghouini, though, was set aside, and he both helped St. Tikhon with his normal parishes, but especially with organizing Syrian parishes. So there are a lot of parishes here in the Northeast, especially up through New York, all the way up to upstate New York and all around, that were established and blessed by Raphael Houghouini, who was later on, it was not too long ago, I think he was glorified by the, I forget what it was, I think it was in the 90s, that he was glorified by the Syrian church, but it was, yeah, something like that. But he was also very, very well known, very famous. Another famous person who is again wasn't part of the Russian Church per se, but Alexis Toth. He was a confessor and defender of Orthodoxy in America. When Alexis Toth came from Carpathia, Russia, he was also a Uniate. He was an Eastern Rite Catholic. When he got to the U.S. the 1890 or so, he reported to the bishop. It was an Archbishop Ireland was his name, who was sort of the head of the Roman Catholic Church in America. Reported to him, and he didn't like Uniates. He didn't like any. He didn't want to have anything to do with them. And so, as it turned out, Father Alexis Toth had leaned towards returning to the Orthodox Church anyway, and to go away from the Unia and towards the fullness of Orthodoxy. And so he ended up bringing not only his parish, he had a parish in Wilkes-Barre. He's called St. Alexis of Wilkes-Barre, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He brought that parish. He brought parishes from Minneapolis and Wilkes-Barre, and a number of these Unia parishes all followed him into the Russian church, into the Russian church. So, and they were all received by Bishop Vladimir, who was the successor in San Francisco after, I think it was, yeah, it must have been after Tikhon. So he's very well known in Orthodoxy in America, Alexis of Wilkes-Barre. Let's see if I'm forgetting anybody innocent. Yeah, John Kucherov of Mexico. Oh, and of course, our bishop. Just go before I start talking about him, Nikolai. We talked about Nikolai. John Maximovich. St. John Maximovich. Was a as a young man his family was a fairly well-to-do family. He went through schooling. He actually went through law school, and then after the revolution they found themselves in Belgrade in Yugoslavia. He was a very prayerful person his whole life. Decided to take a theology degree when they were in Belgrade, which he did. But he was also very favored by Metropolitan Anthony Krapovitsky, who was the chief hierarch of the church outside of Russia. And he kind of raised him up. He eventually became a monk and a hieromonk. He also was taught at the seminary, one of the seminaries in Serbia, along with Saint Justin Popovich, who was another hieromonk at the time. They were both. There's this beautiful picture of this seminary class, and on either end stand, you know, John Maximovich and Justin Popovich, two saints, and two like amazing saints. I mean, Saint John was so full of holiness and so full of goodness that it just flowed forth from him. And the same with Justin Popovich, who was a wonderful saint and an ecclesiastical writer. and a leader all during the communist times. He didn't die. I think Justin Pupfish died in the 1970s, and Archbishop John died. Saint John died in the early 1960s. I think it was right, 67 or 66, something like that. Saint John was had been after he had been made a bishop in the church abroad. He ended up first in China, in Harbin, China, ministering to Russian refugees and other people who had fled Russia after the revolution, ended up in China, ended up in Harbin, China, and then eventually they ended up having to leave with the Chinese Revolution. They ended up having to leave Harbin and ended up in the Philippines. And he was instrumental in bringing this whole great group of people from the Philippines to get them replaced in both in the United States and in South America. There are stories about him standing on the steps of Congress and lobbying people as they were walking in, saying, "No, you have to allow these people." So they altered a law and allowed these people to emigrate into America, not be stuck on this island, this nowhere island in the Philippines. They had this great big refugee camp. He also was spent some time in France as the bishop in Paris, in France, the Russian bishop in Paris. He when he was there, he excuse me, was very well loved. He was always an ascetic. There was a Catholic cleric in the city of Paris, and there's people were saying, "Oh, well, they were, you know," these people would say, "Well, you know, times have changed. There are no saints around nowadays." And he'd say, No, you just have to go and see John the Shoeless," because he would walk around barefoot. He would always go barefoot. So he encouraged the people to go, "This living saint, John the Barefoot." So when he was in Paris, he was very highly revered and did great work there. He eventually came to San Francisco at the time they were building the cathedral, yeah, the Joy of All Sorrow Cathedral. They brought him to help out. It became the Bishop of San Francisco. It was a big problem. There were varying, you know, whenever you try to do something good, of course, excuse me, the evil one comes in and tries to tip over the apple cart. So he got there, and there was a big controversy about building the cathedral, about the monies and this and that. He ended up actually being dragged to court by some people on the parish council, but he won in court, and they eventually finished building the cathedral. St. John was when Metropolitan Anastasi passed away, they wanted to make St. John. They couldn't decide between St. John and who's the other one from New Jersey? Well, there were two older bishops that they wanted to elect one of them, the first hierarch, and they both said no, and they pointed the finger at the newest bishop, who was Bishop Fillaret at the time, and so Bishop Fillaret became the first hierarch of the Church abroad. Archbishop John, he never had very good health. No one in the 40 or so years that he was a bishop, he was never known to have slept on a bed. He sometimes would fall asleep prostrate on the floor. Sometimes he would fall asleep leaning up on a rock praying. He would fall asleep, but he never slept in a bed. The one time he ended up having to go to the hospital for something, and they put him in a they wanted they told him he had to lay in a bed. He made them put a board underneath him. But this was part of his ascetic struggle. He ended up when he passed away, he was up in Seattle, visiting the parish up in Seattle, and he was in this particular room, and he had with him the cursed root icon, which is sort of the reigning icon for the church abroad. He had it with him, and he actually reposed. He was sitting in a chair, and the cursed icon was in the room with him, and he reposed before the cursed root icon. So he eventually was interred in the bottom of the cathedral in San Francisco. They had like a special room. There was a crypt kind of room that you could go down, and they had his casket in there, inside of a marble Marvel crypt. And for years and years, people would go down there and venerate him from the late 60s up until 1994. He was glorified. And I sent that out to some of you the other day about how the story of his, it was his, the anniversary of his glorification and them finding his incorrupt relics, and that and the healings that were coming from those incorrupt relics. There was a priest who had a son who was who had a terrible physical condition, and he was healed from the relics. And so he was glorified as a saint in 1994. It was just before the summer before I came to the Church Abroad. But I can remember even before I was an Orthodox Christian, I would go when I was in San Francisco. We would get together and we'd go to the cathedral and venerate his relics in the bottom of the cathedral. So much that the man who kind of watched over, his name was Boris. He was sort of the door guy at the crypt. When after they opened the relics and found him incorrupt, they took his relics and put them in a new casket. And the old casket, they broke up into little pieces. And Boris gave me a little piece of the casket, so I have that in an icon I have in the altar in at St. Xenia's. So that's a quick survey of some of the saints of North America. These were holy men, and there have been holy women as well. I mean, we could go into Olga, the Matushka Olga of Alaska, a very holy woman. She'll probably be glorified in the near future by the Orthodox Church in America. But there have been and are holy men and women in America, in our own homeland. There are saints in our midst. And there have been saints here since the earliest times, and that it's really the prayers of these saints that have kind of paved the way for us as Orthodox Christians here. Certainly, the blood of the martyrs from the Bolshevik Revolution have greased the wheels, so to speak, in America for the spreading of Orthodoxy. And we have now, I think, Orthodoxy is the fastest growing Christian denomination in America. It's been growing quite a bit over the last number of years, and that while the others are closing up churches, we're still building and opening up churches. But it's the prayers of these saints that came before us, their sanctification, the grace flowing from them into our native land, that has given us some foothold, because without them, all we had were the Puritans, right? And they were not giving us the full bill of goods, or the Roman Catholics, the Spanish, the conquistadores who came and brought the Roman Catholicism to America. Well, they weren't always they certainly weren't spreading the gospel in an Orthodox manner. In an Orthodox context, so we have this gospel. It has been spread, and now it's been given over to us, small, puny as we are, to do the best that we can to both embody this gospel and bring it the next step. To bring it the next step, where we have incredible forces that we're dealing with in the world today that are against us being successful and against the gospel being successful. But Christ has already won. Christ has already won the ultimate battle, and he will win these small battles as well. All we have to do is stay close to him. So we pray to these saints. Sometimes we read, and I encourage you to read the lives of any and all of these saints. And if there's one that really strikes you, it really inspires you, stay close to them. Stay close to them. They're here. They're in our midst. They're in the heavenly realm. And what did Christ say? The kingdom of heaven is within you. The kingdom of heaven is within you. So they're in us, and we have access to them, and they can help us. They can help us by praying to God for us, and like I said, by the fact that they graced our land and kind of made pathways for us through the this wilderness that we call the New World. Questions, comments? Yeah, Ellen.
Do we have any icons in our church of some of these saints?
Yes.
Where would they be? Well, you
Well,
probably haven't found one
right now
yet,
they're all
but
in boxes, but we do
right.
have I think we I don't know whether we still have, I think we have one of Alexander Hodovitsky. I think we have one of Alexis of Wilkes-Barre. We certainly have Herman of Alaska. We have Innocent of Alaska. We have St. John, of course, Maximovich. Juvenali and Peter the Aleut are in an array of Orthodox of saints of North America that we have. I don't think we have Nikolai Vilimrovich. I think we have Raphael Hawaini. I think one of the parishioners brought us an icon of him. And so
What
we
about
do.
Philaret of Moscow?
Philaret of Moscow is not never really was an American saint. We probably we do have him on a saint all of the hierarchs of Moscow. We have Philaret of Moscow. Philaret of Moscow is actually the one who consecrated Innocent. So Philaret of Moscow was the he's the one that he I think he was the one who was the Metropolitan of Moscow. When he passed away, Innocent took over in Moscow. So we have it. There is one icon of all of the hierarchical, the sainted hierarchs of Moscow that we have. And we will continue accumulating more. But we do try to have them. We try, especially the ones that are near and dear to us, and especially the ones that are part of the American land, yeah.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I think just to reiterate what St. John said way back when, sanctity is not just a virtue, it's an attainment of such a spiritual height that the abundance of God's grace, which fills the saint, overflows on all who associate with him. So that's what we associate, if we could associate with them in while they were in our midst. If we can't, obviously historically we can't, they're in heaven now, but we can associate with them as they are in heaven. And that grace that they are filled with, that sanctity kind of flows to us, helps guide us, helps elevate us so that we can follow in their wake. Hopefully without drowning. Okay. All right, well, that's pretty much what I had for this evening. We can call it a night and have a prayer in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. It is truly meet to bless thee, Theotokos, ever blessed and most blameless, and Mother of our God, more honorable in the cherubim, beyond compare, more glorious in the seraphim, who without corruption gave us birth to God the Word, the very Theotokos, thee do we magnify. Glory to the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, now and ever, unto the ages of ages. Amen. Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy. God is with us in his grace and love for mankind, always, now and ever, and unto the ages of ages. Amen. Okay, good night. Thanks for coming. See
Thank
you. Yep.
you,
Good
Father.
night.
Good night.
Good night.